In early 1908, Mexico's indispensable caudillo, Porfirio Diaz, granted an interview to an American journalist named James Creelman. The Creelman interview, as it came to be known, was published in English in Pearson's magazine, and clearly intended for an American audience, especially influential politicians and potential investors. It was probably with that audience in mind that President Diaz dropped an unintentional bombshell. After nearly 26 years in the presidency and nearly 30 years as the most powerful man in Mexico, he planned to retire at the end of his term and would welcome the formation of an opposition party in the run-up to the next presidential election in 1910. Mexico, he assured Creelman, was ready for democracy. Back in Mexico, a wary opposition, including Francisco Madero, decided to take the president at his word and went to work forming political clubs and grooming candidates. They were right to be worried. Within months, the 78-year-old Diaz announced that he would stand for yet another term as president, his seventh. Worse, he would keep as his vice presidential running mate and likely successor one of the country's least popular and least democratically inclined politicians, Ramón Corral. For Francisco Madero, this was the last straw. Plans for a book on the upcoming elections now took on a sense of urgency, reinforced by regular communications from the spirit José, who reminded him of the importance of his mission and even laid out an exacting reading and writing schedule. Under José's watchful and demanding eye, Madero finished his book on the presidential succession in 1910. By late fall, chapters had begun to circulate among colleagues and select family members. By mid-December, the book was printed and ready for distribution. It was released the following month. Mexico would never be the same. Neither would Madero's relationship with his father. Although Madero's family business operated at arm's length from the president himself, they had a protector in Diaz's powerful finance minister, José Limantur, a close friend and sometimes confidant of Madero's father and grandfather. The family patriarchs had tolerated the young Francisco's passionate engagement in local and state politics as long as it didn't adversely affect their financial interests. Opposition politics at the national level was an altogether different matter. His grandfather, Evaristo, compared his political activities to a microbe taking on an elephant, but the elephant was worried. As word spread about the imminent release of Madero's much-anticipated book, his father's letters, usually businesslike and paternal, took on a harsh and even cruel tone.
My esteemed son, I've read some chapters of your book. To tell you the truth, I don't consider you capable of writing a book of that sort, and I would like to know who helped you write it.
In reply, a wounded Madero appealed to their shared spiritist ideals. I hoped that my letter had caused you to meditate on the true purpose of life, and that, knowing that we come into this world to fulfill a mission related to our eternal life, we should give more importance to this mission than to the petty vicissitudes that come to overwhelm all our senses if we don't rise above them. I threw myself into the struggle to achieve liberty for my homeland so that we might leave to our children a prosperous, happy, great country, an environment in which they can develop in freedom, a place where they can evolve with ease, so they might fulfill their grand destinies. If a shared higher purpose weren't enough, he put his father in the difficult position of deciding his son's ultimate fate. Whose will could block me from fulfilling the mission set for me by Providence? The one thing that could, as it is certain that neither poverty, nor prison, nor death will deter me, would be to disobey my father. If I embark on the struggle weakened by you, I will fail, and my failure will cost me my life. Because as you well know, for those who undertake these struggles for liberty, a crown invariably awaits. Success will make it a crown of laurel, defeat a crown of thorns. His exacerbated father pushed back.
My dear son, you're getting caught up in the legs of horses, claiming the role of redeemer when you ought to know that they end up crucified. It's hard to believe that a man like you, who considers himself a good son, exposes to failure the business commitments of your good father. It's hard to believe that a man like you, who ought to help his father straighten out his affairs, instead acts as a hindrance and even contributes to his ruin. You are known as a child who doesn't think or want to consult with anyone before entering into such grave matters. I fear you've taken leave of your senses since you don't take the counsel of sensible people, and I feel that you've gotten in over your head."
There was really nothing his father could say to change Madero's mind, and he must have known that his stubborn son had no shortage of counselors in this world and the next. He held out as long as he could, but finally relented. A telegram conveying the blessings of both Madero's parents arrived in mid-January 1909, just a few days after the book's release. A grateful son responded with heartfelt thanks, but couldn't help adding a patronizing blessing of his own. "Dearest father, I truly understand that raising yourself to the highest regions of the spirit, you have heard only the echo of your noblest aspirations. And dominated by these most beautiful sentiments, you didn't hesitate to do your duty with an admirable abnegation, with a serenity that only a superior man can harbor, with a faith in the future that only animates believers when their conscience is tranquil, because under these circumstances they reside completely with divine providence." Welcome to Revolutionary Spirits, a podcast about revolutions of all kinds and the spirits that shape them. I'm your host, Sam Buffington. This season, we'll be talking about the Mexican Revolution and the life of an improbable revolutionary named Francisco Ignacio Madero. Together with my father, Rob.
Hello, everyone.
A professor emeritus of women and gender studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, we'll explore Madero's remarkable journey from privileged son of one of Mexico's wealthiest families to revolutionary leader, to besieged president, to beloved martyr, and the spirits that accompanied him along the way. As we jump back into the life of Madero, it seems that there's been some big changes for him, both personally and spiritually. Can you kind of talk to us a little bit about what's going on at this point in his life?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about Madero, especially in the sort of spiritist part of his life, is that there's a break. So in this first period that we've already talked about, he's communicating mostly with the spirit of Raul. And this goes from like 1900 to 1904. And then there's a break until about 1907 before we get any more recorded messages. And it's changed a little bit because in the first stages, he was working with the San Pedro Spiritus Circle. And so he was doing this in a group, in a seance format. In the beginning in 1907, it looks like he's mostly just communicating directly, like he's just putting himself in that state and doing the writing and then reading the writing, but without an audience. Like there's no seance involved right at this point. So that's changed. Now, one of the things that's interesting is when he comes back in 1907, the first spirit that he channels is Raul. And Raul says, you know, you've really fallen off the wagon here. You know, you've really sort of backtracked on a lot of spiritist things. Madero's spent 3 years intensely involved in politics. So it might be referring to that. It could be more personal. It could be that there's sexual transgressions or something. Who knows? I don't want to speculate or accuse Madero of things he didn't do.
Right.
But certainly Raul seems to think that on the level of advanced spirits, Madero's been, you know, backsliding a little bit. And so he said, "Welcome back. We know that you've now decided to sort of get back on track with things, and that's great. But I have news for you, and it's good news. I'm going to pass you over to another spirit, and that's named Jose. And you're going to be talking with Jose, and Jose is going to be functioning as your spirit guide. And the reason I'm going to do that is because I, Raul, am going to be incarnated as your second son." Now, Madero has no children at this point, so he doesn't have a first son either. But Raul tells him, "I'm going to be incarnated as your second son, so you're going to need a spirit guide, obviously, who's still in the spirit world."
Right.
And this is sort of the tragic piece of this, because Madero is never going to have children. Madero and his wife are never going to have children. The tragic piece of this is that Raul says, "And this, my appearance as your second son is going to prove the truth of all that we've been saying in these sessions." And then this happens. There's mention of it in the first few communications in 1907, and then they really drop off, and it just disappears. And we'll talk about what Jose has to tell Madero in a second.
Who is Jose? Do we have any idea who he's supposed to be?
Well, this is a tricky question because people just aren't sure. Madero never tells us. He doesn't tell us. Like with Raul, it's really clear. This is Raul. In life, he was my baby brother who died tragically. And he's the guardian angel of the family.
Right.
He's my spirit guide. He's the family's guardian angel. We know who Raul is. Raul has a personality. In the memoirs, he describes him as, you know, being this lovely child who died tragically, right? So we know Raul. Jose, it's not clear. It's possible, and some historians have argued this, that it was a brother, another brother named Jose Ramiro, who has also died, but he was older. And Jose Ramiro appears for a second in the transcripts. I mean, there's one message from that's signed Jose Ramiro. But it's probably, it doesn't seem... And I think most folks would agree that Jose Ramiro is Jose, is the same person. And he was just shortening the name. Other people think that, you know, this is Madero in contact with advanced spirits who are going to give him advice about how to be a leader, right? And we'll talk about that. But give him advice about how to be a leader. So maybe it's Jose Morelos, the great independence war hero. And maybe Jose, Madero doesn't want to say Jose Morelos, but that's kind of what he's got in mind. And the kind of advice he gets from Jose would be the kind of advice you would get from the spirit of Jose Morelos.
Right.
At least okay. In Madero's mind.
Right. So Raul seems to be giving more of this like general, you know, how to be a good man advice, more personal like growth advice and taking on that role. And that Jose seems like much more like this kind of capital L leadership advice and that moving from now that you are a good man or you're well on that path, you now have goals and like, I'm going to help you get to those goals. Is that...
That's absolutely right. So now with Raul, it was mostly just about transforming yourself into a good man to be worthy of a mission. But with Jose, it's about the mission. Okay, you've proven yourself worthy, just as you just pointed out. You've proven yourself worthy. Now you need to do something about it. And I need to prepare you not just to be a good man, but to be a leader of men. Mm-hmm. We're talking about men here. I need you to prepare you, again, as you said, big L leadership. And so this is a fundamental change. And it's tricky because being a good man, you can develop sort of alternative ways of, you know, so that challenge sort of normative masculinity a bit, especially toxic masculinity, just by being good.
Right.
Being a leader means you've got to convince other people of the need to do things. And there's these models of normative masculine leadership that are tied into militarized leadership. People like Porfirio Diaz, who was a war hero. And so that's one register, and Madero doesn't want to go there. There's the sort of other register, which again was Porfirio Diaz was offering, which is something we call masculinist protection, which is where Porfirio Diaz says, "I'll protect you," meaning the Mexican people, and sort of cast in this role, in the role of women and children, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll protect you in exchange for you giving up some of your liberties. And that sort of masculinist protection thing. And Madero doesn't want to go there either. So he doesn't want to be like a strong man, but he doesn't want to also, a strong man in an oppressive sense. He doesn't even want to be a strong man in the benevolent sense of like, okay, just surrender a little bit of your freedoms and I'll protect you. He needs to develop an alternative form of masculine leadership that sort of jibes with Spiritist principles. And that's different from what's come before. And that's what Raul, that's what Jose is helping him to do.
So a few times in this podcast, we've kind of heard that this idea of Madero as the apostle of democracy. This obviously plays into both like his spiritualist leanings and his political identities. So how are these like identities intersecting at this point in his life?
Good question. Madero is it referred even in his lifetime, like even if this at the time we're talking about, people were referring to him in the press as the apostle of democracy. So this is not something that historians decided later that's what he was. This is something, this is his title at the moment. This is part of his appeal, is that he's the apostle of democracy, which again, as you pointed out, suggests that there's a spiritual, moral, ethical element to his advocacy for democracy and his spreading of democracy. As an apostle, he's also spreading the good word about democracy. And Madero took this really seriously. He wrote a manual espírita, a spiritist manual that was really, what he was trying to do was take the ideas of people like Alain Kardec and other French spiritists and producing a document that could be read and understood by normal people, not even just normal people, but uneducated people. Right. And so this was like a spiritism for the masses is really what this kind of was. And Madero, when he talks about encountering spiritist ideas for the first time, describes them as so simple, so beautiful, so new that I was seduced. And that's what he's really trying to do, but he's trying to do it for the masses. And so he writes this spiritist manual. He's writing it during the revolution. It's like 1909. Madero's got a lot of other things to do, mm-hmm. but he thinks it's important. Now, this is a tricky game for him because he wants to keep his spiritism a bit on the down low because he knows that it's going to create some opposition. This is a very Catholic country, so he knows there's going to. But in the back of his mind is the idea that once I become president, and once I've sort of assumed this position of leadership, we can eventually start integrating some of these ideas into public education because there's this commitment to public education that he's also really very much advocating. Now, he's not saying, let's set up spiritist schools, because the spiritists in Mexico want him to advocate for that. He's like, no, we're not ready for that yet. But eventually we need it. But the first step is democracy. And why democracy? In spiritist thinking, free will is crucial. You've got to freely make choices in order to evolve as a human being. Well, if you live in an authoritarian state and people have robbed you of your free will, how can you exercise that? And if you can't exercise that, and he thought Mexico was getting worse, if you can't exercise that, then what do we do about it? And we bring back democracy so people have the free will so that they can evolve spiritually. So there's a democratic imperative here about spiritism.
Kind of thinking about other apostles of democracy in Mexico, right? The one that comes to my mind is Benito Juarez. How did he play into this thinking for Madero?
Madero was a huge admirer of Benito Juarez. Like maybe Jose is Jose Morelos, who he also admired very much. But the Mexican leader of the 19th century that Madero worshipped, probably isn't too strong a word, who he really felt was like the epitomized Mexico's aspirations to democracy, was Benito Juarez. And Benito Juarez is a super interesting figure because he doesn't fit the mold either. In some ways, he fits the mold less than Madero does of leadership, of sort of leading the nation. He was like several inches shorter than Madero. He's like 4'8" tall, and he's a full-blooded Zapotec Indian from Oaxaca, right? So mm-hmm. this is not who you'd expect to be the sort of symbol, the icon of Mexican liberalism and liberal democracy, would be someone like Benito Juarez. But then at one of the very last communications, he's communicating with Jose all along, but one of the last communications before they break off in 1909 is a message of encouragement, like as because Madero's at this point become a presidential candidate, a message of encouragement from a spirit who signs itself BJ. And everybody's in agreement that's pretty much got to be Benito Juarez. And so this is Madero channeling the spirit of Benito Juarez, who's saying, yes, you need to carry on the good fight.
Can you remind me just really quickly what made Benito Juarez famous? Like why, was he just a president? Was he a military leader? Was like...
Yeah. I mean, Benito, well, he was president. He was never a military leader. He was a lawyer by training. And that's sort of how he got into positions of leadership in the Mexican government in the middle of the 19th century. But he would never. And this is the other thing that Madero very much admired about Benito Juarez. He never put on a uniform. He always dressed like a lawyer. He resolutely refused to let generals take things over, including resisting Porfirio Diaz in Porfirio Diaz's first attempts to come to power was to oust Benito Juarez. Mm-hmm. and Juarez put an end to that. So Benito Juarez is a really different kind of person. And his message to Madero is a validation of Madero's continuing the struggle of great men like Benito Juarez. Now, Benito Juarez is a great man including for people like Porfirio Diaz, despite their disputes in real life. And after Benito Juarez is out of the picture, Porfirio Diaz also endorses Benito Juarez, but he was a universally beloved figure and symbol of democracy. And that's who Madero aspired to be and took inspiration from. And
so it seems to me that up until this point in his life, that Madero has been more of a reformist than an outright revolutionary. Was it just the election of 1910 and just that kind of like, Porfirio Diaz going back on his saying that he was open to opposition made that change?
Yes, it's exactly right. I mean, what happens is Porfirio Diaz goes back on his promise to not run for re-election. So he's going to go up for election. He's going to be 80 years old he does get elected in 1910. When he's elected in 1910, he's 80 years old. And he's gone back on his promise. And he's appointed someone as a successor who Madero thinks is absolutely the wrong man for the job, Ramon Corral. No, so this is a problem for Madero. Now, he goes ahead and runs as the opposition candidate. They form an anti-re-electionist party, right? And he runs as the candidate of that party against Porfirio Diaz. Madero uses a lot of his own money to travel all over Mexico. He's a brilliant political campaigner, and he's traveling all over, meeting with political clubs all over Mexico, running against Porfirio Diaz. At some point during that process, Porfirio Diaz, knowing probably that he's going to rig the elections, starts worrying about Madero. What are we going to do about this guy? This guy's actually a serious threat to my regime. Mm-hmm. And so he jails him at one point, he has local officials in San Luis Potosí jail Madero. So Madero is under house arrest in San Luis Potosí. And by that point, it's pretty clear. So he manages to escape from exile and go and go into exile in San Antonio, Texas, and then in New Orleans for a while. And so Madero is in exile, knowing he's going to be arrested if he goes back to Mexico. And then he issues something called the Plan de San Luis Potosí, or the sort of manifesto, right, which is calling for an armed insurrection. Right. And it's not only calling for an armed insurrection, it's giving a date, November 20th, 1910, we are going to rise in revolt. And so at this point, Madero has clearly, as you were pointing out, has clearly recognized that the only way to get this regime out of power, especially if even with Diaz dying and Ramon Corral takes over, it's just more of the same and worse, because mm-hmm. he actually admires some things about Porfirio Diaz. He thinks his successors are going to be worse. So he's taking it seriously, and now he's thinking armed revolt. We really have to that's what it's going to take. And this is a big shift for him.
It also seems like it's maybe a shift that's hard to make good with Spiritism, right? Like, it seems like Spiritism is an evolutionary belief system rather than a revolutionary belief system.
Yes.
And so, does Madero have to do anything to make that work for both like himself and in a more public kind of way?
Yes, absolutely. And especially for himself, I think, because You know, people are accept the notion of armed revolt in Mexico. It's the history of the 19th century Mexico, or various forms of armed revolt. Mm-hmm. You know, on the part of liberals, conservatives. You know, people throwing out the Spanish, all of that kind of stuff. So armed revolt is not a problem in the larger society as a response to entrenched governmental corruption, for example. But it is. As you pointed out, it is kind of at odds with Spiritist ideas, which are very sort of about the evolution. Spiritism accepts reincarnation. And so you're reborn life after life after life, and you're working on your spiritual advancement. And it also saw that in larger terms, like societies are working on their spiritual advancement, but it's gradual. It can be life after life after. You've got a lot of, you know, there's a lot of lifetimes that you go through before you get to become an advanced spirit.
Right.
And so societies are like that too. So Spiritism does favor evolutionary change.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start calling for armed revolt, like how do you justify that with your Spiritist principles, if you're Madero?
Right.
Like other people aren't having, people are pushing him, have been pushing him all along. Like, we need to take this up to the next level. And he's been resisting that until he gets arrested and it's pretty clear that nothing's going to change without armed revolt. And then he has to kind of figure out how to do that. So one of the ways he does it is to sort of go back to some texts that were kind of on the edges of esoteric texts that people had been reading, including Spiritists, but also Theosophists, right? And one of the most important texts, and it's an important text in world history, is the Bhagavad Gita. So they have to go back to this sort of sacred Hindu scripture and the Bhagavad Gita, which is part of this even older scripture called the Mahabharata. And Madero goes back to these sort of esoteric teachings from the South Asian, you know, cultural past in order to sort of recover ways of thinking about it. Now, the Bhagavad Gita is interesting, and we'll talk more about it in the next episode, but the Bhagavad Gita is interesting because it's a dialogue between an Indian prince named Arjuna and Krishna, who's his charioteer, who's also an incarnation of the god Vishnu, who many Hindus consider to be the supreme being. And so Arjuna the setting is that there's two armies facing each other. Arjuna is one of the leaders of one army. And there's an opposition army, and Arjuna has Krishna drive him out to the middle of the battlefield and look at both the armies. And he said, "How can I kill these people? These are my family. These are my mentors. These are my friends on the other side and on this side. And if we have this battle, there's going to be this mass destruction. And how can I live with that? How can I deal with that?" And Krishna then tells Arjuna, "You need to do your duty as a warrior. You were born into the warrior caste. You need to do your duty. You need to uphold the cosmic order. And there's no like karmic consequences of you do it, as long as you do it selflessly. As long as you don't do it in anger, as long as you don't do it to protect your personal interests. If you can do it selflessly, there's no karmic debt that you're going to incur. You're just going to, because you are doing your duty." And so this document, and Madero is going to write commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, including up until the last days of his presidency. He's going to be writing these commentaries. The figure of Arjuna, who clearly, Madero writes articles with the pseudonym of Arjuna. So there's something about Arjuna and his dilemma that really resonates with Madero.
Right.
But it also, by having recourse to this document, which represents ancient wisdom, he can, in a sense, validate it.
So as we move into this next kind of part for us, I think one thing that we got brought up a lot in the introduction that we haven't talked about yet is the reaction of Madero's father to him taking on this like larger leadership role in the country and kind of jumping the queue in some ways, right, of the patriarchy in his family, right? That he now becomes the central figure in this family. and is making decisions that affect the whole family by taking on this like opposition leadership role, and that clearly isn't sitting well with his father. And I think that that's just like a really interesting dynamic that we're seeing, is that as he's like becoming more important in some ways, right? More known. And like being seen nationally as a, you know, like we've been saying, capital L leader, that's really like creating tension in the family.
It's definitely creating tension, especially with his father. At this point, Don Evaristo, who's the grandfather, is ailing. So he says he does write to Madero, expresses concern, you know, he makes the comment about it's like a microbe taking on an elephant. Mm-hmm. Don Evaristo is present, but his father is the one who really takes it personally. And you can see that his father, who would be in line for the family patriarchy, were something to happen to the ailing Don Evaristo, his thought that he might take it offense at his son kind of, like as you said, jumping the queue and moving sort of into national politics, when this is a family that's, you know, very wealthy, certainly influential, but not they're not national players. They're players in northern Mexico. In Coahuila, they're a huge deal. They're important because they're rich, but they're not a big family. And all of a sudden his father's just like, you know, like, wait a minute, what are you doing? I mean, he's worried at one level. It's simple. It's like he says, you're messing up the family business. What if Porfirio Diaz decides to take revenge on us? What then? And he is. And there's evidence that Diaz is sort of behind the scenes. There's lawsuits and things like that. And his father's like worried, you know?
Well, and it seems like in that he was both worried about, you know, his son's personal safety, right?
Like his mom is really, his mom's, right? That's what his mom's letters are about. Like, stay safe. What are you doing taking on this guy? This has consequences.
Right. And then, but you know, I get that from his dad's stuff as well. Yeah. Like clearly that's part of it. Right. And then part of it is this worry about like, man, you could ruin our family. But it also, there seems to be like in those quotes, like, really is this like kind of personal affront, right? Of like, like this isn't, you're breaking a mold, or you're like, this is like an insult to me.
Right.
You know, and I'm personally like insulted that you would do this. And that to me, whether he would think about it this way or not, definitely seems like related to, you know, jumping the line in the patriarchy and like disrupting, you know, his chance to be the leader of the family. So his father's chance to like kind of take on the leadership of the family role.
Right.
And that maybe that's still happening in the family. You know, his son is still in some ways asking him for permission to do this, but is also like, no, I'm just going to do what I'm going to do. And like is now the important person in the family. He's the one that the rest of the Mexico sees as the leader of the Madero family.
Yeah, when you talk about Madero, now you're thinking about the presidential candidate, the apostle of democracy, Francisco Madero, hijo, mm-hmm. the son of, not Francisco Madero padre, you know, the father.
Right.
Absolutely, and that creates a sense of challenge. And his father, like, there's a lot of correspondence and it's preserved correspondence between Madero and his father, you know, from pretty early on. And certainly once he gets involved in the family business, and it's always very respectful. I mean, Francisco, the son, is always deferential to his father. He's willing to like make business decisions that his father doesn't necessarily agree with, but then his father accepts those decisions. Like, okay, you know, I warned you, you know, but not to do this kind of investment or not to do that. But his son is being really successful. He's expanding the family business. His father kind of gets it. And that seems like kind of normal tensions within the sort of patriarchal hierarchy.
Right.
You know, it's not a problem. It's like your son gets to push back. You don't want a son that you can just like, you know, steamroll over. And his father respects that. And Madero really respects his father. My dearest, papacito, he calls him, right. Mi querido papacito, He's really respectful and loving with his father. And you don't get the sense that his father is like really, a hard-ass patriarch. Mm-hmm. He's pretty respectful of his son too, and even of his son's independence. But once Madero becomes a national political figure and starts to challenge the Diaz regime and put the family business at risk, his father not only worried about the family, but he takes it personally. Right. It's like, as you said, it's like, wait a minute, I'm the family patriarch, and when I get this angry, you don't see me get angry very often, if ever. You right. don't see me be cruel to you ever. But in this instance, you've really crossed the line. So just the tone of the letters, as you could tell from the introduction, right. just the tone of the letters, you can sense his not just his worry about his son's safety, about the family businesses, but that you've crossed the line here mm-hmm. in terms of authority.
Well, and clearly he made decisions for the family. You know, that he made that yes. break, right? Yeah, I'm asking you for permission, but he publishes the book, right? And is like, I'm doing this. Right. And that is a decision that affects the whole family, and I don't care what.
Right.
I won't say don't care, but I'm going to to do this. And I am essentially like.
I'm on a mission. This is divine providence. Right. And family's important, but like it says in the Bible, Jesus says, leave your family behind and follow me. So Madero's like leaving his family behind as he goes off on this mission from divine providence to bring democracy to Mexico. And that's, that's clearly rough on his father. There's one moment where Madero, this is I think 1909, and it's just before he becomes a candidate for president. He goes to meet personally with Porfirio Diaz. So this is this interesting moment. He's in his mid-30s. Porfirio Diaz is like this almost mythical figure. He's been, the most powerful man in Mexico for over 30 years. He goes to meet him, and Madero's reaction is interesting. And one of the reasons it's interesting is because he writes back about in describing in detail this meeting with Porfirio Diaz, he writes to his mother.
Okay.
Like he usually writes to his mother, like, how are you doing? I hope your health is better. Those kind of like son to mother things. This is about a political matter, which would typically he would have written to his father about, but he knows better. I mean, it's clear, mm-hmm. I think, I mean, right. maybe I'm speculating here, but I suspect he knows better than to write to his father, because what he tells his mother is, this guy may have been something back in the day, but he's a doddering fool now. And he said, and he tells his mom, I'm encouraged by this, because it's pretty clear this guy's condescending to me. He's telling stupid war stories. He's just, he's a doddering old fool. And he said, this gives me a lot of encouragement, because now I feel like I really, this is a generation that's ready to be toppled, And he compares him, this is where the family stuff gets interesting. He compares him to Don Evaristo, his own grandfather. And he said, Don Evaristo is much more on top of things, even though he's really ill. Mm-hmm. Even though, he's in decline is kind of the subtext here. Even though Don Evaristo is in decline, he's still got it all over. Yeah. Porfirio Diaz. And the other thing that's interesting is writing to his mother, he knows his mother is going to show this letter to his father. He knows that.
Right.
And, but what it allows by writing to his mother, what it allows him to do is get that out there and this challenge to the patriarchy out there. But it also means that his father doesn't have to respond directly, because it wasn't written to his dad. So he doesn't have to he doesn't have to get personally offended and take it on unless he wants to.
Right.
And he doesn't, at least as far as we can tell from the correspondence, his father never responds to that description of the interview with Porfirio Diaz. But
the funny thing about thinking about the Madero family and like those tensions that come up in this setting is like really realizing that, that never actually came up in our family. For a number of different reasons. I mean, I'm not speaking for you, but it never seemed that you were interested in taking on the patriarch role in the family and like kind of making that challenge. you know, nor am I. And that's not been a thing. And that, but I think the one area of tension that is kind of funny is this the family guns and how that played out, and that, you know, your dad having these, like, you know, this the he had a number of different guns for, you know, he collects everything, so
a cache of weapons. Okay, right?
but like a lot of those, you know, didn't have specific meanings and got, you know, divided up among whoever. But that there were these, like, certain special guns that needed to be, like, passed down, and they needed to be passed down to the firstborn son. So it needed to go to you, right, and it needs to go to me, and it needs to go to Victor, my son. And both, like, the tensions in the family of, like, there's some people who want those, and, like, my wife was like, we're not having guns in the house. and you know, that was, like, a thing that, like, you know, I had to tell your dad a couple times, like, no, I, like, really don't want them. Like, and yeah, that, like, you know, I think in my, like, sense to appease people and appease him in particular, right, I might be like, I might have been like, oh, I'll go put them in my attic, or, you know, like, I could, like, store them to, right, make him happy. But Laura really doesn't want guns in the house.
Right.
And so then it's, right, like a whole nother, like, thing to figure out. And that we just kind of, like, I mean, we don't have a solution yet, but, like, it's just kind of a...
They're just sitting in a gun safe.
Yeah, yeah.
waiting for...
Yeah, and you know, so there's like, that, you know, I do feel like that was, like, the place... and then, you know, just funny on our part is that, you know, we gave our kids both our last name. So they're Wilson Buffingtons.
Right.
And when we were trying to decide, are they Wilson Buffingtons or Buffington Wilsons? Like, how are we going to do that? Right. It was definitely, I think Buff would prefer it if they were Wilson, right, Buffingtons. And since we don't have, like, a strong other feeling, like, we're going to go with that. But that was definitely part of that, like, wanting...
Yeah, and it's interesting that he had such a clear, it was so important to him to be this transmission of people with the Buffington name first, but the firstborn son, mm-hmm, through it in the, even though he wasn't a firstborn son.
Right.
He was, like, the third son, right?
Yeah.
but for him, in terms of his patriarchal line, which began with him, it was really important that I get the family guns, that I pass them on to you, or at least keep them safe, so eventually some firstborn Buffington son could get their, you know, could come into their rightful inheritance.
Right.
And of course there's a lot of, you know, psychosexual symbolism around guns and stuff. So you can run a whole, like, phallic, you know, interpretation.
I knew you were going to go there.
Yeah. but we won't go there. Okay. Right. but all I'm saying is that why guns were the symbol, and,
right,
why they were a source of tension, but you're right. I didn't try to jump the queue. I didn't, right, want, I don't, you know, I didn't want to take on, you know, the extended Buffington family. My father was really good at reaching out to, you know, his larger extended family. And he was, disappointed, maybe not all he was, but, like, you know, he was puzzled and discouraged and perhaps disappointed, but I didn't want to take on that role. I didn't want, mm-hmm, to be doing those things. I wasn't looking like the patriarch,
right,
in waiting.
Right.
Which I think he actually wanted me to be, but he wanted me to wait.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that was just like a, you know, as we've been thinking about these, like, parallels, I think that was a funny one. And I think it speaks to, you know, these, like, real breaks in traditional masculinity and just those things that are just no longer important to us. And so, right, I think that both for you and for me, that, like, that idea of being the patriarch is not really an appealing or a goal, right? Like, it's not like, oh, we're waiting for our turn to,
right,
to take,
right,
this on.
Well, there's another piece here in that Madero is the firstborn son of a firstborn son, right? Mm-hmm. So, and our family parallels there. But one thing that distinguishes you from Francisco Madero, hijo, right, is the fact that you have sons too.
Right.
Now, you'll remember we talked earlier in the episode about Raul promising to come back as Madero's second son. So Madero was clearly thinking, at least at that point, that I'm going to be a father. I'm going to be, you know, carrying on the patriarchal line. But it's increasingly clear that they're not going to have children. Mm-hmm. And that's not, in fact, going to happen. And it would be, of course, you know, speculating that had Madero had children, had he had those sons, he might have been more protective of those sons and more concerned about his own safety and less willing to challenge the establishment because he had those family responsibilities, which is your position.
Right.
You know, you're thinking about, oh, I need to, because patriarchy matters. My father was always a very generous patriarch. So in raising my own sons, I was aware that he would support me in that.
Right.
You know, if something were to happen to me, he'd take over, he'd make sure you guys were okay. And so that sense of passing on patriarchal responsibilities, because, you know, patriarchy has a lot of problems, but one of the things it is also about is protecting people. Mm-hmm. They surrender their rights and responsibilities, but never mind. But protecting people, and we both share that. Mm-hmm. And Francisco wasn't in that position.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, an interesting point. And I also then wonder if that, like, not having that enables him to take on this leadership role nationally.
Yes.
That, you know, even so, as he's at odds with his dad, and you see his dad writing these things like, I don't think you could have written this book.
Right.
Right. Like, but that. Nationally, people are buying into him as a leader.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. What's interesting in when you're thinking about how to sort the formation of leadership, of masculine leadership, especially when it's kind of, when it's different from conventional notions of masculine leadership, and you need to get buy-in. It's not just about who you think you are, despite all of our slogans about be all you can be and just do it and those kinds of things. You need to get buy-in from somebody else. Now, it's pretty clear at this point that his father and his grandfather, you know, the microbe and the elephant thing, or, right, you know, you didn't write that book. His father and his grandfather aren't buying it. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is by 1909, when his father writes that letter, other people are buying it. So Francisco Madero Padre, the father, might not be buying Francisco Madero Hijo's version of events, but people like Emiliano Zapata are. They are buying into the Maderista revolution. And when he becomes the opposition candidate, they give him their support. And some people as different as Emiliano Zapata and Pascual Orozco and his lieutenant Pancho Villa, you know, who are in the north. Emiliano Zapata is in Morelos, which is south of Mexico City, in very different parts of Mexico, different agendas, revolutionary agendas, and they're both signing on to the Maderista revolution. And so Madero's alternative version of masculine leadership is being bought by people in different parts of Mexico and with very disparate views, and people that you would assist, as we already talked about, these are macho leaders. You know, these are more traditionally masculine presenting, you know, leaders of armed revolution. And and Madero's getting buy-in. He's getting buy-in from Venustiano Carranza, who's much older than he is and is the governor of Coahuila, so more politically powerful than Madero is. And Venustiano Carranza signs on to Madero.
Yeah.
And so this is one of those really interesting moments, because he takes this alternative model of masculine leadership and really gets buy-in. And that's his gift. That's the thing that Madero brings to the Mexican Revolution, is his gift for coalition politics. You know, a very current issue, right?
Right, right.
His gift for, like, speaking to people across all of these ideological divides, you know, different kind of issues, all of those kinds of things, different social positions, and he's speaking to all of them. And again, part of it is that he's doing the hard work.
Right.
You know, he's touring around, he's meeting with people, he's meeting with all these clubs. He's got this endless correspondence, thousands and thousands of pages of correspondence. He's really doing that kind of work, but he's getting buy-in, which is, I think, one of the really interesting things.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of part of it, you know, just really reminded me of early Obama, right?
Right.
of like that same kind of, you know, somehow managing to speak to, you know, progressive activists and getting this like buy-in and people working incredibly hard on his campaigns, as well as kind of like, you know, moderate Democrats and jumping that line and the coalitions that he was able to build. While, you know, to some degree having, like, I don't think it was as extreme, but I think also presenting a different kind of masculine leadership than is typical of U.S. presidents, right? Right. I mean, obviously because he's a black man, but also, you know, I just don't remember any of these like pictures of him with guns, right? Like I'm hunting with so-and-so. And I distinctly remember that about John Kerry when he was running, that like, right. You know, absolutely. He had his like weird spray tan and then, you know, would have all these pictures of him like hunting and doing like manly things, right? Like right. Chopping wood or whatever, right? Right? And right. And that all the weird stuff that Putin does, right? Right? That like Obama didn't, like, it's not that he, you know, he, you know, played basketball, you know, and like, it's not that he didn't have.
Yeah, he was athletic, right?
Right. But it was just like, it just wasn't that, you know, and he didn't get angry, right? Even as he's being like slandered all over the place and all this, like these racist attacks, that he would kind of calmly defend himself or retort. And that like, though, so it was this like different like version, you know, and it's right. It's different. Obviously the antithesis of, you know, Trump and his like, you know,
right.
His, you know, super toxic masculinity, but also like, you know, like everyone, the thing that everyone liked about Biden, right, is that he's like pithy and like, he's, you know,
sassy.
Yeah. Sassy and kind of, yeah, like he's going to get kind of angry sometimes and, you know, say something dumb and like, but you know, Obama was not that, but was able to build that kind of coalition. So I see this like kind of,
yeah,
if not political parallel, but like,
well, there are parallels in the sense that Madero is really, really, and you can see it in his comments to his father. You know, Madero really believes that people make their best decisions when they're tranquil, when their spirits are tranquil. You know, mm-hmm. when they're in a state of serenity. You know, and he talks a lot about that, being making rational decisions because you're not emotionally invested. Mm-hmm. And even the Bhagavad Gita, you know, Krishna is talking to Arjuna. You need to be. You can't be self-interested, mm-hmm. Or you're going to incur karmic debt when you slaughter all these people. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to be above the fray.
Right.
And Obama really conveyed that. He was always the grown-up in the room, mm-hmm. speaking sensibly. You know, mm-hmm. and you could experience that as him patronizing you, which people also did for Madero, mm-hmm. or you could see it as a sign of his maturity and his rationality, his mm-hmm. you know, that he's thought things through and he's been sort of impassionate about it. He's really like, you know, put his passions, his personal, you know, egotism aside and really considered the matter. And he really mm-hmm. projects that
right.
as a man. Another interesting parallel is that's where you have somebody who's even more of a gender radical than Madero was, you know, in terms of alternative masculinities would be Gandhi.
Right.
Because you've got somebody who's, you know, walking around in a loincloth and you know, and deaf and really slight, you know, just mm-hmm. not looking like a masculine person. His authority is a moral authority.
Right.
And he's selling nonviolence.
Right.
I mean, not selling. He's promoting nonviolence.
Yeah.
It's like this is what our revolution is about. We are not going to fight people. Mm-hmm. Now, interesting that Gandhi was also a big reader of the Bhagavad Gita.
Right. You know, one thing that I've always, you know, as we're talking about Gandhi that struck me, and I feel like, you know, was behind a lot of other, you know, kind of social justice leaders, civil rights leaders, and I'm wondering if this is true of Madero at this time too, is that, you know, they kind of work Martin Luther King like this, right, too, right? Is like, that part of like what works for them is this threat of like a more radical, a more violent person behind them, right? Whether that's like Malcolm X or that's like in Gandhi's case, like, you know, armed independent fight for independence.
Right.
Or in Madero's case, is it like, well, like a lot of people are signing on because it's like, well, you know, if it's not him, maybe it's Pancho Villa, right? Or like whoever, right? Like, I don't know the
details of that. Emiliano Zapata was the one they were really scared of.
Right.
Pancho Villa comes later
right.
as a scary figure.
Yeah.
But he was the Attila of the South, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That was Zapata. Yeah, they were really afraid of him. But you're absolutely right. I mean, Madero presents, and I think all of these folks that you're mm-hmm. talking about, Martin Luther King, as opposed to Malcolm X.
Right.
You know, or Gandhi, as opposed to sort of people who are advocating sort of armed revolt against the British, you know, colonialists. Those, yeah, Madero is even though he's accepted the necessity of armed revolt at this point, or armed insurrection at this particular juncture, he doesn't seem like a warlike person, and he's not.
Right.
I mean, he tries to put an end to the violence as soon as he can. Porfirio Diaz is gone. He's really trying to calm things down. We're going to talk about this next time when we talk about some of the failures in his president, when he actually becomes president. But he's the one that wants to disarm the Zapatistas mm-hmm. and is trying to convince Zapata to have his soldiers, you know, turn in their arms and sort of accept, you know, the new system. And we'll get to your land issues, you know, and we'll talk about what happens in that particular story.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to get into that. and I feel like that's probably will be more parallels to some of these, like the leaders that we've talked about. At
right.
this point.
And I think if there's a takeaway here, it would be that in the episode, when he's working with Raul, mm-hmm. he's becoming a good man. When he's working with Jose, he's becoming a spiritual warrior. He's getting advice on how to become a spiritual warrior, mm-hmm. but that this is convincing not just to Madero. I mean,
right.
it's not just that his self-transformation is convincing to him. It's also, he's also able to project that because, you know, again, we're not just all we can be unless other people buy into that. And what's really like astonishing about Madero is that he takes his own self-transformation and convinces other people that he is in fact the man to lead the armed insurrection against Porfirio Diaz, who's this mythical masculine figure.
Thanks for tuning into Revolutionary Spirits. In the final episode, we'll take a look at Madero's troubled presidency, his tragic death, and his potent afterlife as the martyred spirit of democracy.
Before we go, we have some very important folks to thank. Our amazing producer, Steven Renderos, the wonderfully supportive Center for Humanities and the Arts at the University of Colorado Boulder, several terrific historians, especially Manuel Guerra Luna, Enrique Krause, C.M. Mayo, Roberto Narvaez, Alejandro Rosas, Ignacio Solares, and Yolia Tortolero Cervantes. And last but never least, a special thanks to all of you for listening to Revolutionary Spirits.